This is August 71 at the Amherst AAS meeting, interview with Al Barrett.
So what was the story on this OH search at NRL? Was it your impetus got it started?
Well, it's hard to say whose impetus. When I got there, exchange of correspondence between Ed Lilly and George Desmonis. George Desmonis and I were office mates at Columbia.
I see.
And he was doing his PhD about the same time I was, but his PhD was on the microwave spectra of OH. Not at 18 centimeters, but at higher frequencies. But because Townes had made him aware of the possibilities of OH for interstellar radio astronomy, Desmonis had calculated where the 18 centimeter lines would fall. So, and because Townes was my thesis advisor, we had talked about OH.
I see.
So it was understood, and in fact was stated in my application for employment at NRL, or application for a postdoctoral fellowship, that a part of my time would be spent doing an OH search. Because Townes was my thesis advisor, my office mate was George Desmonis, and it was just an obvious thing to go ahead with.
Was it measured in the lab, or only calculated theoretically?
No, it wasn't measured in the lab.
When you did that search, right?
Yeah, what Desmonis had done was measure a number of microwave states of OH. But his apparatus was such that it wouldn't propagate 18 centimeters, so he didn't measure 18 centimeters.
Right.
And in fact, I don't think he measured anything less than, I'd have to check in the literature here, but I think it's about 15 gigahertz, or about 2 centimeters, and above, he measured. But once you know the constants of the molecule, you can calculate down to what it ought to be at 18 centimeters, if the theory is in good shape.
Right.
Well, the only theory of lambda doubling that existed then was Van Vleck's, which was done in something like 1927. So, Desmonis expanded the theory and added higher order terms into the Hamiltonian, and took these into account, and because of his measurements then, he knew the molecular constants, and he figured he could work back and arrive at a reasonable number for 18 centimeters. And as I recall, the uncertainty there was about 10 megacycles. So that's how we got into doing that. Now, we started that search. Let's see, I got there in January.
56.
In 56.
Yeah. This is on the 50 foot.
Yeah.
That's all that existed.
On the 50 foot dish on the roof. And the first thing I had to do was build a horn, because we had no means of illuminating it. And I built the horn and I tested the horn out. And I guess a mixer was also built, because all they had at that time was a 21 centimeter receiver. And then we went ahead with the search from there. I guess it started sometime in the summertime. I know I recall arriving at NRL in the evening for the evening shift when it was still daylight, so it must have been sometime in the summertime.
Now, was this an extensive sort of search? Many sources, reasonable integration time, or did you?
Well, we were using the hydrogen line observations as a guide as to where to look.
Yeah.
And most of our time, not all of it, but most of it, was spent on Cassiopeia, because it was circumpolar, and because it had the sharp hydrogen line absorption features.
Right.
But we also looked occasionally, I guess, at Taurus and the Galactic Center.
Now, did you search over this whole, I guess it would be a 20 megahertz?
Oh, yes. All the time we were, all the time we were on any one source, we were also scanning in frequency. And it was obvious then, obvious in quotation marks, that we should be searching in 1667. But we now know that that's not entirely the case.
Right. Yeah, sure.
But that's what we did. Now, we had a bit of an alarm at one point because we saw something. But we saw it in the mission. And we didn't understand it. It was a fairly strong signal then.
In CAS, was this?
By standards of those days, yes, it was in CAS. And, I don't know, it was maybe 20, 30, 40 degrees, I don't recall. But it was strong. But it was in emission. And that bothered us. And we chased that around quite a bit. And we finally figured out that we were observing a meteorological balloon in our other image. I don't know if it's up or lower, that doesn't matter. But in the other image of our passband. And, or, now wait a minute, I'm not entirely certain about that. We were frequency switching. And maybe it was just in the other band of switching.
Yeah, either way.
But that would have put it in absorption, wouldn't it? Anyway.
That would have, if it had been a transmitter.
So. Yeah, I think so. Oh, it was in the other image. But we went off CAS. I recall the excitement about that. We went off CAS, and it didn't go away.
So, roll it out.
Yes, but we were stuck. But we did chase that around.
Well, in retrospect, should you have seen the OH at that time? Or what do you think is the story? First of all, did that estimated frequency, did that cover the...
Yeah, we were scanning the proper frequency range. And in retrospect, knowing now what we know about CAS absorption, no, we would not have seen it.
Your sensitivity was not enough.
That's right. That's right. The electronics in 1956 wasn't what it was in 1963, and it was a smaller antenna, and we just never would have seen it. So we undoubtedly scanned the right range, but we never saw it. Now, had we looked at some of these unusual sources where OH is amplifying, we would have seen it.
But, of course, there was nothing particularly about those sources at that time. In fact, the Westerhout catalog wasn't even in existence then. So.
Oh, no. We had absolutely no reason at all to imagine anything like an amplifier in interstellar space.
Or even to know to look at something like W3 or W49.
That's right.
Or anything like
that. That's right.
Yeah.
So
that's...
Subsequent events, if we had pointed the antenna at the right place and scanned in the right frequency, we would have seen it. But that's all hindsight.
Yeah. Now what about the eventual discovery? I guess it was in 63. Apparently you continued your interest in looking for OH.
Oh, yes.
Was this the next time you tried?
Yep. I went to Michigan, and there was no possibility there. They were just beginning their program in radio astronomy, and there was no possibility of any OH studies. But in 1961, I went to MIT, and one of the programs uppermost in my mind then was to have another look at OH, because in the intervening 5 years, Towns and his students had measured the ground state lambda doubling of OH. So that automatically removed one of the three variables that was involved in the search, alpha and delta and the frequency. So we knew now what the frequency was. And nobody else had bothered to look. So, that was one of the things uppermost on my mind. Now, along with this was the fact that Jerry Wiesner had a graduate student named Sandy Weinreb who was working on a new spectral line device, the autocorrelator. And it was a natural marriage between my interest in OH and Sandy Weinreb's device, the autocorrelator, to marry the two of them and look for OH.
The only other problem, I guess, was to find an antenna.
Well, Sandy's thesis was to build the correlator and use it on an astronomical measurement. And this he did. He used two astronomical measurements, both of them negative. One was the Zeeman splitting in Cassiopeia.
Right.
And I guess Taurus, I'm not certain about that. I'd have to look at the literature. And the other was the 327 megacycle Betorium search.
Right.
And as I say, they were both negative. But he got his PhD and he went to work for Lincoln Laboratories. And then I arrived at Tech to start up radio astronomy. There was no radio astronomy at MIT before I got there. And the question was, what antenna do you use? The haystack wasn't in existence.
Did you go to MIT expressly to start a radio astronomy program?
Oh, yes. Well, there was a Millstone antenna, 84 feet, of Lincoln Laboratories, which was used off and on for various military and other programs. And we began to explore the possibility of using that antenna for radio astronomy. At that time, Lit Meeks was also at Lincoln Laboratories. And both Lit and Sandy were responsive.
This is an interview.
Hi, Don. How are you? It's all right. Be recorded. Don't be bashful.
Say hi.
Hi. At that time, both Lit and Sandy were responsive to using the correlator on OH problems. So, that was the beginning, I guess. There has to be a beginning of that experiment. And it began in, I suppose maybe late 62, early 63. By October of 63, the receiver was on the antenna, the correlator was built, and the fellow by the name of Henry, John Henry, I think, but you better check this.
J.C. Henry, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Had written the program for doing the transform out of the correlator into the computer that they had at Millstone at that time. It had no commercial number because it was one that was built at MIT. And he was one of the ones who, if he wasn't instrumental building, at least he was the only one we could rely upon to actually tie the thing in to give
so
us the answer.
You had an online display then?
We had an online display finally, but only because of Henry's efforts. Well, the experiment began in October with the correlator, with a mixer radiometer in the Millstone antenna, and with Henry's programs to give us the spectrum out of the back end. And the first couple of nights, at least the first night, and I think maybe a couple of nights, the results were negative. And we had standing wave problems and mismatches in the antenna and in the receiver inputs. But eventually these were solved. And the first real good night, where we were hopeful of actually seeing something, we saw something. This was again on Cassiopeia. And there was an indication of a line within the first half hour. Now, that makes a great statement, but the first half hour of observing, when you see something, you don't believe it.
Yeah, right.
You go back and check it, and you do all kinds of things to make it go away. And in this case, it wouldn't go away, and we got very excited about it. And we didn't have the antenna every night, but every time we did, we would show up and we'd do different things, and the line would still be there.
Was this the first astronomy that was ever done on that antenna, or had it done some radar astronomy maybe earlier? Just as a...
Oh, I don't really have an answer on that. It was the first radio astronomy done, but that wasn't your question.
Right, the radar.
The radar astronomy, this was the antenna that initially reported seeing Venus and had a value of the AU as a result of having seen Venus, which ultimately was an error. So I'm hesitant to answer that question.
Okay.
It did some radar astronomy, but it was wrong.
Okay.
So there you are.
So you found it in Cass.
Yes.
And you found both lines, right? So you're pretty sure of the identification, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We found the first line, the 1667 line.
Maybe I should have...
It was a couple degrees, as I recall. And we did the usual test of moving the line and seeing if it would move, and going off source and seeing if it would go away, which it did. We looked for 1665, which is smaller. It was of the order of 1 degree. And it was there. But the only thing we had to go on in this whole thing was the hydrogen line detections at that point, and we went back and looked up how they verified they had it. And you wait a while till the motion of the Earth around the Sun gives you the proper Doppler shift.
A different Doppler shift, yeah.
And I tell you, those were...
Now, what do you mean by wait a while? During a day? Or?
No, it was 2 weeks.
2 weeks, oh.
It was 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks' time, the thing shifted by 10 kilocycles, which are now called kilohertz. But we were very, very nip and tuck.
Right.
Very touchy and excited and concerned over that 2 week time span to see if it would move.
You didn't have enough resolution, I guess, to do enough with the Earth's rotation to be able to pick that difference up. I mean, that's a half a kilometer a second, but I guess that wasn't quite enough.
No, we weren't working with that resolution.
Yeah.
And we didn't have the dish that long. And we had it mostly at night when nobody else wanted it. We did look in the galactic center, and we had a horrible baseline problems, which we now know, as the Australians found out, that the baseline problems were the fact that
huge
that it was a very small absorption feature on the edge of a much larger absorption feature,
right,
because
right.
We were using the hydrogen line observations as a guide, as they did.
Right.
And if you look at the first Australian paper on OH, which was the first confirmation of OH, there's no spectra given at all. That's because they didn't understand the baseline problem.
I see.
And in fact, it was a small dip on the edge of a very, very large dip.
Was this in Nature, this Australian paper you referred to?
The Australian paper was in Nature. We published our paper in Nature. And... there's a peculiar aspect of this, which I suppose ought to be recorded, because we discovered this right at the time that the ITTU or ITU or something or other was convening in Switzerland to allocate frequencies. Well, we had submitted our paper to Nature, and we were worried about if we told the American representative of the ITTU in Switzerland that we had seen this, and if the press picked it up, would Nature publish our paper? So what should we do? Well, the press office at MIT, the public relations office at MIT, was very helpful in this respect. We told them our problem. And it was agreed we ought to send the American radio astronomer accompanying the American delegation at the ITTU a telegram, which would tell him about the detection, name the frequencies, because at that time they weren't all that tied down, and write the editor of Nature that we were doing this, and hoping that no matter what happened, we wouldn't prejudice our case for publication in Nature. Well, this we did. And we sent George Swenson, the University of Illinois, who was a radio astronomer accompanying the American delegation, that we had seen these things, and we gave him the frequencies. What we didn't know was that he posted it on the bulletin board at the ITTU, and he called van der Hulst at Leiden. And he asked van der Hulst, what is the possibility that this is atmospheric OH? And we had given the frequency to about, I think it was 7 significant figures. Van der Hulst realized that if we knew it that well, it had to be interstellar, because if it was atmospheric, it would be broadened more than occurred. But also, Australia had representatives at the ITTU.
Right.
And the Australian representative picked this thing up off the bulletin board, wrote down the frequencies, and cabled Bolton in Australia that OH had been found at these frequencies in interstellar space. Well, as a result, the Australians had a little bit of a head start on the confirmation ahead of anybody else, because they had the frequencies. Well, after we had sent Swenson the telegram, we began to have second thoughts about the advisability of doing this, you see. So I called him from my home one night in Switzerland. And we explained the concern. He told me he had spoken to van der Hulst. We explained all the details of the experiment and confirmed to his agreement or his satisfaction that it was indeed interstellar OH we were seeing. The following morning, he took down the telegram that had been posted.
But
the damage had been done to a certain extent. The press hadn't picked it up,
right,
which was good. But the Australians had.
And so they very soon, I guess, got a receiver going of their own.
Australians moved on it very quickly. And in no time at all, I don't know what no time here means. I could go back and dig the dates out, perhaps. But between the time we had sent Nature our letter and the time it was published, I got a cable from the Australian Embassy in Washington that had received a cable from John Bolton in Australia. They had confirmed the existence of OH in the Galactic Center.
And you didn't even know that they were doing it at all. Or you didn't even know that they knew.
No, I hadn't then.
So you wondered how the hell they could confirm it, since it wasn't even known to them.
No, I did know. That's right, I did know. And the reason I knew was because the Australian representative at the ITTU Geneva had talked to George Swenson.
I see.
So he told me that the Australians already had it. So I knew that they were onto it.
Yeah. Was this a radio astronomer, the Australian representative?
His name I don't recall, but his name I was told at the time, and it wasn't anybody that actually rang a bell. So I think he was an administrative type or an engineer type or something. Well, I immediately responded to cable by Bolton in that I was thinking again of the hydrogen line situation, where there were two of the three papers of the hydrogen line thing occurring in the same issue of Nature. I sent him back a cable saying that our paper would be published, thus and so issue of Nature. Is there a possibility he could get a cable in confirming it? Well, I didn't get an answer by cable. Eventually, I got an answer by a letter that they had already missed that deadline, and they weren't all that certain of their data. And the reason was they were having these baseline problems, So, that whole thing went by the boards, and our paper finally appeared, and eventually there was a series of publications from Australia on the Galactic Center.
Right, right.
But the first one of which had no specter whatsoever.
Now, did you follow this work up at all at that time, either in absorption or looking at other sources? Or
yeah, we kept at it. Mainly in Cassiopeia. There was a problem with observing time, and we didn't have too much observing time. And then I went off to Russia, and when we came back, Haystack was in operation. And then we went into operation with Haystack on a full-bore basis.
Right.
And there we found three things that were important. The first thing we found was the Cassiopeia line, if you look at it, high resolution, was split. And now I've got to go back and check whether that was Haystack or Millstack. I think it was Haystack. It was split. It was a single line at the hydrogen frequencies. It was a double line in high resolution at OH.
Right.
We also found then that at that time, now this was now 1964, almost a year later, the so-called mysterium began to pop up, and OH had been found in a mission. So we started studying that, and we immediately found, which others hadn't done yet, just because they hadn't gotten around to it, it was polarized. And then we very rapidly found it was circularly polarized.
This was the paper in Science on W3OH that came out of that?
There were two of them, one of which, that it was linear polarized, and then there was a follow-on paper that it was largely circular.
No.
And by that time, Al Rogers was involved in the OH studies, too.
On the OH absorption, was there any other group at the time working on that? The
absorption?
Same time? Yeah, initially working on that in more or less in competition with you? Or?
Oh, yeah, lots of people jumped on it right away.
No, I mean, not after they knew about the discovery, but simultaneously or...
Oh, yeah.
Or even before.
Yeah, I went to a meeting of people who were concerned with radio properties of Venus. This meeting was held out in Pasadena, California, JPL. And one of the speakers at that meeting was a radio astronomer from Pasadena. And this was early 63, when we hadn't yet discovered OH. And I think it was Barry Clark, but I'm not absolutely certain about that, but I'm very unreasonably certain. But he gave a paper about the radio properties of Venus at L-band. And the peculiar thing about it was that his L-band frequency was 1,666. Not 1,600 or even 1,660, it was 1,666. And I knew at that time we were instrumenting Millstone to go ahead with OH. At 1,665 and 1,667.
Yeah.
So obviously I got concerned. Why did he have a frequency down to 1,666 if he wasn't really concerned with his frequency? So I figured he was using that equipment for OH. And we were very concerned about that at the time we were doing our search. And after we knew we had it and were trying to publish it, we were worried that we'd get scooped. Well, I was talking later with Radhakrishnan, and he was the one who was looking for OH, and he was indeed looking for OH at Caltech. And I don't know how much off the record this one ought to be, but he told me he was getting no support for his interest. And I hope I get to edit some of this and look it over. But he was getting no support for his interest in OH at Caltech. But he did make one look one night when the equipment didn't work well. And his results, of course, were negative under those circumstances.
Yeah.
It was his first look. And if you recall, I told you earlier, we had a number of nights when we didn't have things tuned
right,
on. But
right.
We just had negative results, too. When you make the usual mistakes, you make the first time.
Sure.
But he did indeed look, and I guess, I don't know the actual dates, but I would guess that he looked ahead of us. But had equipment problems, never went back to it, didn't push it, and didn't see it.
Well, was there any other group that you knew about?
No, I don't think there was any other group. I did have a letter when I was still at the University of Michigan, and this must have been back in the late 50s. I had a letter from somebody at Jodrell Bank while I was at Michigan asking me about OH. No, it wasn't the late 50s. It must have been 1960, because I wrote back that I was leaving Michigan, going to Tech. One of the things I was very interested in doing at the top of my list was the OH search, again.
That was their interest also.
What?
That was their interest also, I take it.
I guess, but I asked Lovell about this a number of years later, and he had no idea that the whole thing was underway. So I don't think it was underway. I think I heard from a graduate student who was just asking a question.
Yeah.
So I don't honestly think they were very serious about it, because after all, he would have known about it had they been.
Yeah. Now what about the emission I guess was discovered at Berkeley, right? And they call it Mysterium and so forth.
Get drawn into the argument as to where it was discovered. Helen Gunderman at Harvard and Harold Weaver and his graduate students at Berkeley, as far as I know, discovered it essentially the same time. But the Berkeley group was the first one to print.
Right. But how did it escape your attention? Or is it just a matter of telescope time, you didn't have any more, or you weren't thinking of those sources? Because even then, there was nothing peculiar about W3 and W49, particularly, even though the WestRock catalog was out. And NGC 6334.
It has escaped our attention for a number of reasons. One was telescope time. Another was it was at 1665 and not 1667, where it was strongest. And I spent a large part, not a large part, I spent 3 months of 1963, the last part of 1963 in Russia.
So that lost, by the time you got back, it had been discovered.
No, it was discovered in early 64, but you see, there wasn't that much time for radio astronomy on Millstone, and Haystack wasn't yet operational.
Yeah, yeah.
So, as I recall, the first thing we did on Haystack at OH was either we looked at Cassiopeia with high resolution, we had a bigger signal then, or maybe that was done at Millstone. I'll have to check that, or you will. But as I recall, the first real excitement at Haystack was on the emission and the fact it was polarized.
Yeah. Well, Lyd Meeks tells me that there is an archive at the Millstone Library, or that some secretary has one there. So I'll definitely want to be taking a look at that on the OH discovery.
I'm sure there is.
Well, that pretty well...
I hope we're putting it through.
That pretty well covers that one. I was just wondering if there's any other thing in radio astronomy which of note that you think you might be able to contribute to. I may not know the history as well as you do, as things you were involved in and so forth.
Well, I don't know. Maybe sometime. Not right now. Maybe sometime we can chat about the first radio astronomy experiment done from a space vehicle.
Which was that?
Microwave measurements of Venus.
Oh, well, that's right. I've forgotten that was...
Yeah, but I don't want to get you started on that now.
Okay.
I don't want to get started on it now.
Well, yeah, if you could just tell me anything else, though. Like I said, you don't necessarily have to go into it now.
Anything besides that?
Yeah.
Oh, I suppose, Woody, if I give it some thought, I was at NRL when the first Venus measurements were made, the first planetary measurements. Well, I don't mean the first planetary measurements, because obviously they were Jupiter.
Right.
But I mean the first microwave thermal emission.
Was there any line searching in Michigan or anything of that nature?
None. not while I was there.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Oh, okay. Maybe we can talk about Venus some other time.
Yeah.
But, sure, I want to get to New Hampshire now.
I can understand. I've just been...
You probably want to get to eat.
That ends the interview with Al Barrett at the AAS in Amherst, August 1971.